You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Now, it may seem like I'm whispering, and in a way I am. It's because I'm quite tired, if I'm honest. Yes, I'm still in Manchester. Am I here for a long time? A long time? I'm here for a bit more, but I've got to get this intro done now on a Monday night. I don't want to break the podcast illusion. But I've got to record this now because I've got to move tomorrow down south for a few days, and I need Griff to get this sorted, which he's going to do, you know, because he's the best. What have I got to say? I've got so much to say, and I'll try and keep it brief. First off, a massive, huge thank you to all of you for your comments and downloads. John and Laura McClaw, yes, you're right, you heard it. They are top people and bloody gorgeous people to hang out with. And I would happily spend time with them and call them my friends any day of the week. And you should too, because they're fucking brilliant. And then what happened? Well, we only met a bloody legend, Niall Rogers. Oh my God. God, were people buzzing about that? I was buzzing for like 2 days afterwards. He's so warm. He's so kind. You heard it. He answered all those questions. And that format for me was so weird. It was so different. And I'll be honest, I was nervous about asking questions to a person. That's not what I do. I have a conversation with people. I don't ask questions. So to do that was well out of my comfort zone. But I had a thought that I may do that more with certain people, especially in a live capacity. If I meet people for the first time and I don't have an hour with people, that might be the way to go. And maybe I'll get better at it. But yeah, I think I'm going to start doing something like that. That might be quite good. Onwards to next year at Kendall Calling. Maybe what we'll do is we'll have this, the Two Shot Podcast, the legend slot, and we'll, it's funny because we asked a certain legend who was performing this year at Kendall Calling to come on and do this slot months ago, maybe 6 months ago when it first got announced, and yeah, we got blanked, we got no response, which was lucky for us because we got Niall Rogers. If you haven't gone back and listened, please do, because some of the little stories and anecdotes that he comes out with, you aren't going to hear them anywhere else. It's Niall Rogers. I have to pinch myself all the time because of that. So this week is episode 93, and I'd been in talks with this week's guest, which is Jessie Cave, who I adore. I'd never met, but I adore her work for a long time. And then myself and Griff were in London for 2 or 3 days. We finished certainly one day of recordings, and I found out that Jessie was at Soho Theatre reprising her show Sunrise. And I texted her, I went, you're sold out tonight, but I would love to come. I'm not asking for a freebie. I don't do that, but I'll pay. Anyway, she got me a ticket on the door and I went to see it. Now, there'll be some of you that have seen it, and it is a beautifully honest depiction of a relationship. And not just any relationship, but their certain relationship. Suffice to say, I left the show elated and slightly teary. I did cry. It was brilliant. It was so brilliant. I didn't see Jesse at the end because now we've had this discussion, I know why I didn't see her at the end. She was going through a lot of stuff. Now, I've got to preface this episode because it deals with certain topics and subjects that are of a sensitive nature. We deal with death and grief and how to handle things and how we navigate life when trauma comes in our way. So, yeah, if you're not in the best place, don't listen to this now. You don't have to. It's going to be there. It's not going anywhere. But it's fair play that, you know, I've got to warn you about this. I don't want you listen to this thinking it's all fun and games, because it really isn't. But it's an important episode, and it was very important for Jessie to come on and talk. And I'm so grateful that she did. Had I known, because I never met Jessie until she came in and recorded this, had I known, you know, where she was within herself, there's no way I would have said, yeah, come on, let's do it. Because you know that we look after our guests, we support our guests. We're not, you know, press, we're not crude in any way. We support what they do and what they want to do and what they talk about. I think it's really important that I let you know what goes on in this episode. So look, don't be scared. If you're in a good place, listen to this. It will enrich your life. She is incredible. I was a big fan before. I'm bigger after this. She's just brilliant. And stick around for the intro, because she's up in Edinburgh this year doing Sunrise for the last, I think it's 10 shows, only 10 shows she's doing. I'll give you the dates in the outro, okay? But look, thank you so much for being here and downloading and sticking with us. Episode 93, guys. Episode 93. Okay, I've waffled enough. I'm very sorry. I'm very dramatically tired. But let's do this, okay? This is episode 93 of the Two Shot Podcast, with the one and only, the individual that is the beautiful Jessie Cave. Enjoy, and I'll see you at the end.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
But she's like the token person that you see reading out the tweets. Essentially, Jessie.
How did you? What did you think of that when that happened?
Because I was like, I get what you mean, but you've just done it in the wrong. You've said it in the wrong way. And I went in, and the whole script is really crude. It's all about shit, and I'm not good at talking about shit. Like, I'm just like, and I wanted to say to them, I thought I'd have the guts in the room to be like, you wouldn't, if this was me, because I'd have to write it too. I wouldn't write. I don't that. Have to do crude stuff, no. Do I? But I didn't. I just did the crude stuff. I felt disgusted with myself and I did it. And it was on autocue, and the woman kept doing the autocue too slowly for how I spoke. So it was just a mess, and I felt so shit about myself. And then they were like, do you mind just reading for this other female sketch show that we've got? Do you mind just reading now? And if I had read it, I would have said, like, no way, it's awful. Like, no. But because I was in the room and they put the pressure on me, I had to be like, yeah, of course, yeah. I sat down and I did it, and it was just awful. And then I left the room feeling like, those are two projects I shouldn't have done, like, shouldn't even be reading for, and I've just I felt just so gross, you know? You're just too scared to say, no, that's actually, I shouldn't be doing that.
Are you?
Because unless you keep working, you're not going to get the job. So I need to seem like I'm, that I need those jobs to look like I'm still working so that I can still do my stuff.
I know, but then again, you need to do the right jobs that connect with you.
Yeah.
So then that can facilitate doing your own stuff.
Yeah, but then it's like so long a gaps between things that actually are right. And then you might not get the audition for the right thing because you haven't been seen. So, like, I find it constantly, like, every so often I'm like, I actually really need that one because that would buy me a few more months of not working.
Yeah.
So I can do my own stuff. So
do you feel that under pressure when you go into the rooms of stuff that you don't want to do, that you want to please them? Or do you not feel that you can be 100% you and be honest?
I am now, but it means I'm not getting any work because I'm just being to myself. So, and whereas Bibi, it's so interesting because she's, like, she doesn't, I mean, it's so awful that it comes down to such basic descriptions of people, but, like, she doesn't wear glasses. She's not quirky. So she's much more, like, leading actress type person. And the roles that she goes up for, I mean, she auditions all the time. She's much more able to be different people, but I'm not. I'm much more, like, I'm just me, really.
Well, because you think people see you and that's all they see.
Yeah.
They can't imagine sort of taking the glasses off and just taking the hair down.
Yeah.
And
I sometimes do play ball and I do that kind of thing. But, like, it's...
Would you not think you're true to being who you are if you do that?
Yeah, and so now I've decided I'm just writing it. But I have been writing it for a long time and it's, like, taken forever, but it's slowly getting there. But I just made that decision. Like, I'm never going to be the leading person. I've got to write me as the leading person, myself.
What does that do to you and, like, happiness? Does that sort of chip away at you?
No, partly because I've been lucky with how well it's gone with writing.
Yeah.
Which has given me confidence to keep writing. And so...
Did you lack confidence before?
Yeah, and I only wrote because I thought that... I know, I think I feel like more naturally a writer than an actress, but, like, I feel like if I didn't... I was lucky not to get work early on and have to find a way of surviving.
To create your own material.
So very early on, it was like, right, you can't just be an actress, that's not going to make your living, so you've got to do something else. So from day, you know, very early on, for now a decade, I've been doing two or three jobs at the same time.
Yeah.
Whereas I think for actresses who've grown up acting and got quite lucky early on so that they got lulled into a false sense of security of, like, oh, you can just work and that you keep working.
Mm.
And then they hit a moment in their mid-20s where they're like, oh, actually, I haven't got a job for a bit. Oh, I'm going slightly insane. And they don't have any tools.
But they don't have an outlet that you have.
No.
That you can just sit down and you can start writing the next show.
Yeah. But also, because I started as an illustrator and so that's still my main day job, my identity is much more in those things. So, but it's so dangerous because then you get an acting job and it's nice and you're treated really nice and you're, like, made to feel like it's really important. And then you get sucked into that. And then your ego comes back and then you're like, oh no, I could see myself as doing this. And then you don't get another job for months. So, like, it's just like constantly fighting with your ego to, like, just try and remain at a nice level. So that you never get too big and you never get too low, so that you can keep working in some form.
But that's really hard.
Yeah.
Because it is a roller coaster.
Mm.
And, you know, sometimes the bad days do outweigh the good days.
I mean, I don't know anyone, I don't know many actors who are happy.
It's true, though.
I don't know any.
But I know loads that are putting on...
Yeah.
The facade of everything's fine.
But that's the same with comedians, though, because I spend more time with comedians. And it's the same. That, like, it's... Everyone's looking for a break. But I don't think the breaks don't come... I think I don't believe in the break coming now. I've lost all hope of getting another job because of such rejection for so many years and such close things where you're like, oh, that could have been me. But it just wasn't because they chose that girl. And I think being that close to your life being different and seeing how different it could have been by seeing the programme and seeing how their career went and seeing what job they got next.
Do you do that? Would you watch
other stuff? It sometimes happens inevitably because you're just watching something. You're like, oh, yeah, I was really cut up about that.
Yeah. But you don't, like, seek it out and torture yourself by going to look through it.
I used to, but I don't anymore. Because it's so far away from my life now that it's like, I'm so out of the game and I'm in my own game. Like, so, for instance, being at this thing on Sunday.
Yeah.
Most people were there with a big production company, like publicist, agent, you know, like my agent and my I don't have a publicist, but like the Soho Theatre, for instance, the people who produced the show.
Yeah.
Like, they all forgot about it. So I just turned up, like, on my own.
They all forgot about it.
Well, no one said, like, good luck today or anything like that. No one. Whereas, I mean, I just got dressed out of, like, my mum's bathroom and, like, turned up with... I mean, I could have made it such a big deal, but I just thought, well, I'm not going to do that because I don't have the resources to do that, and I also didn't believe that I would win, and I just thought there's no point. But then halfway through, I was, like, looking around and realising that we were really alone, that it was just me and my sister and everyone else had teams.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wait... I had a kind of a reason to have a team today and I didn't get one. And like, I felt a bit like, oh, is that the only opportunity I'm ever going to get at a thing where I've actually have a reason to be there and I've wasted the opportunity? And then I thought, well, no, like, I'm going to make sure I have another opportunity. And next time I'll be confident enough to have a team. But I just wasn't confident enough to do that kind of thing this time. So I think I'll get there again if I work really hard.
Were you more confident years ago, say like 10 years ago, to where you are now?
No, I've never been confident.
Never?
No. Have you? Have you got more confident?
I don't know if confidence is the right word for me, but sort of more comfortable.
Yeah.
In my own skin, I suppose. And
that does happen as you get older. I feel much more comfortable now.
Yeah.
And looking at Bibi and realising you just are a bit... you're lost until until you feel like you've done good stuff, and then when you feel like a bit more capable and prepared for all types of situation, then it's less of a grind. I do feel like I'm more equipped now for life, but that's probably being a parent too.
I was going to say, are you a confident mum?
Yeah, very, and that was the only thing that I ever wanted to do.
What, be a mum?
Yeah, like that was. I wanted to run an orphanage. Like,
yeah.
I just desperately wanted to like have so many kids and look after people and like and that's what I thought I was going to do. But then I ended up doing weird. I went to art school and I never got a boyfriend. And then the first script I wrote after my first Edinburgh show was about trying to have a baby via sperm donation because I couldn't get a boyfriend. I was like, well, I've got to do it somehow. I want to have a baby now. And I was only 20.
Was that something you were really looking into?
And I did. And I actually went to a sperm clinic.
Did you?
I got to the final stage. You had to have a psychiatric assessment, obviously, because I was 20 and I was wanting to have a baby. I was like, what is she doing? and then I passed the psychiatric test, which I was really happy about. And then
that
they were like...
so many boxes already.
And then I didn't go through with it because I got a job. Like, and then I got onto that treadmill for a bit, and then I forgot about, but then I did write this script. And then I lost that with kind of being ambitious. And then, weirdly, I got pregnant by accident, like on a one-night stand, and my whole life changed in a night. With, even if I hadn't have had the baby, and even if I had lost the baby, I remember that night being like, this is it. This is, my life is different now because I know I want to have a baby.
Yeah.
And I want this thing to
grow. You felt ready for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm ready for it. And overnight, my ambition kicked in again in a different way. It was like, I need to do as much as possible to earn money for this child. So it was a different type of ambition. It wasn't like, I want to be in this thing and be this role.
It changed because it wasn't about you.
Yeah, it was
and
about
everything changes. It's all about this other person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's such a relief because then I was able to do work that was much more basic and like, you know, tiny little jobs, which I was thrilled about because they were like, that's 2 days. That's it. That's 1 day. That's half a day. That's nothing. But, yeah, like, it's money to live, to pay for rent this month.
And also, maybe sometimes with those types of jobs, you're not emotionally invested. So you're doing it for the right reasons, which is to earn that bit of money, to put that bit of food on the table, to pay that rent, to buy those nappies, to get those clothes, whatever it is, yeah, it facilitates that.
Yeah.
So you're freer, I,
yeah,
think.
Yeah, much freer. And I also learned, because I never get big parts, they're always little parts, I started to appreciate that, because I also appreciate now how different I am, which means I'm never going to be the lead. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is, really. And then I realised that no one really... This sounds awful. I watch a lot of TV, but I realised the things I was going up for and the things that I wasn't getting, say, no one really watched anyway.
No.
Like, they never were that big. They never were the hit that I thought they were going to be when I didn't get the job. And then when I did do little roles that were liked, like I did a tiny, tiny, tiny part in Black Mirror, and that cameo, essentially, it was like a paragraph, but it was quite funny, did more for my career than any job I've ever done. And then you realise, oh, like, it's so weird, the business, because you, yeah, don't... Some things can just be so nothing for your career, and some things can be the... Just change everything.
You just don't know. You don't, yeah, know. You would never, ever have thought that doing that in Black Mirror would have set fires around and sparked little things off.
Yeah. And it makes it, it just changed my perspective. It was like, I don't need to be aiming for big things. It could just be, you just have to be good in the little thing you do. And if you're good enough in that, then someone will see it.
Exactly, but that's all you need to focus on, is just focus on you doing that job to the best of your ability and not thinking down, yeah, the line of what's going to happen.
Yeah, and then the other thing I learned, which I've only realised lately, so I've had a really awful time personally, like I lost my brother, and my whole perspective on life has changed now that I've realised what it can be.
Yeah.
And how short it is and how fleeting everything is. Everything has changed. So going to auditions for, like, things that are really bad or things that, for some reason, are getting made, when things that people are trying so hard to get made for years, yeah, aren't getting made. I now have a sense of, like, can you swear on this? Like,
yeah.
Swear. Like, fuck it. Like, this... I just see through the bullshit now. And that is a gift from my brother, because he just saw it from the... So he was expelled from RADA, my little brother.
Right.
And he has... He just... From going to... A drama school like that, he had just immediately sensed it. He was like, this is not for me, I'm not going to work like this. And he just, I mean, he was just so known for just not
conforming,
yeah, ever in his life. And I've kind of taken that on from him going. I'm now like, right, I'm going to take that on for him. I'm not going to put up with this anymore. I'm going to see through the bullshit. And also, because I think before it happened, I was like, no, I won't get that part because people like me don't get that part.
Or, so you're already doubting yourself, yeah, before.
Yeah.
So you're projecting the worst possible thing, yeah, before.
Like, so I've had scripts for years with people, and but no, it won't get made because, like, my things don't get made. Like, they always get rejected, like the last hurdle. They won't get made. Now I'm like, no, it is going to get made, and I'm going to make it get made, and I am going to fight for him. And it's just given me a new... like fire, which is good.
That's so positive, Jessie. That's really
I
good.
Know. And then doing my so you came to see my show the night before he died.
Oh, Jess.
So like it's all like it's like and I had to go on. I had to keep going on to do them. Partly because it was sold out. It was like a lot of money for me. It was. It made me realize how it can help, it can save you acting, and it can save you performing. It actually did. For an hour a night, I was like in a dream world. Like I was actually able to forget and to make believe, which is such a big part of it, and why doing good work matters.
Yeah.
Because it does help people, and I'm not saying my show helped anyone, but it definitely helped me.
It helped me.
It also depressed you.
It also made me Going to the toilets and having a little cry after it. Do you remember? Because I texted you, I went, thanks, sorry I didn't see you. I was just off there having a little cry. But it was so fantastic. But we'll talk about that in a bit.
But yeah, it's made me realise that actually you can make something that is good and can help someone.
And it really helped you just switch off just for that hour.
And my mum, like, so my mum comes to every show. She's basically my stage manager. She makes my props. Like, she does everything for me. And all of my other siblings. She couldn't obviously come immediately after, but she came the next week and she helped me set up again. And everyone at the theatre was so great to us and really supportive. And it just helped us doing something practical and literally putting the set up and getting me ready and then going home. Like, it was in you know, the immediate aftermath of the shock and the trauma, it was just doing tiny little things helped so enormously. And actually doing an hour of a show where I knew it front to back. I've been just finished my tour. I knew it inside and out. I'd done it over 120 times.
Yeah.
It was so good for my brain just to do something and to know I could do it and just to have an hour of, let's pretend this hasn't happened. I don't know how I got into that, but yeah, it's just I feel a new sense of fire to try and believe that it could be me rather than before this happened. I think I would be like, things like that don't happen to me. And then we went to LA on a holiday. I know it's not the immediate place people think of for a holiday.
After you finished the show?
Yeah, we just got back from...
Did you all go as a family?
So I took my mum and my sister and my kids and my brother. And I did have to do, like, a couple of little meeting things, which I only did, like, reluctantly, because I've always been scared of America, because I've been, like... Because I did have an excruciating experience in my early part of my career where I went to try and get a manager after I was in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And I had, like, an awful time. I was treated like an alien because of how I looked. I was told to lose weight two or three times a day.
What?
I mean, I was a little bit bigger, but not that much bigger. I was told to lose 60 pounds by somebody. 60 pounds!
There'd be nothing left in you. What's
going
on?
How could she know how much 60 pounds is?
That's ridiculous.
It was amazing. I was told to... I had headshots done by a woman who did Disney Kids. Because I think she thought, because I was in Harry Potter, like, I could fit into Disney. And she saw me. She took the glasses off my face, which I find just... For people who don't wear glasses... I mean, people who do wear glasses would understand how offensive that is. She said, I just had to fill in your eyebrows. That was the first thing she said to me. And then she proceeded to scream at me while doing my photo. And the photo she took looks like I am running away scared through the woods after something awful has happened to me. I look terrified in this photo. Anyway, so I was kind of going back to redeem myself after that experience. And I would usually go into these meetings and be like, I'm sorry, my name's Jessie. I'm sorry, my name's Jessie.
Immediately apologising.
Yeah. But this time I went in with things I'd written that they had liked, that they wanted to meet me for. And I was like, let's do this. Like, I was like, I'm not going to shy away from it anymore. I'm not going to be scared. And it's just so liberating. And it's awful that something like your brother dying can make you realise how great opportunities can be, how great life can be, that actually has happened.
But whenever something so deeply traumatic happens, you don't know what's going to come out the other end.
Mm-mm.
And how it's going to change you, do you?
No. And I think I used to always get at him for, like, not putting himself out there, not, being more efficient or doing more. And then something like this happens, and you realise, oh, it doesn't matter. Nothing matters as long as you're alive and you're happy and you've got the people that you love and you've got enough.
That's it, isn't it? Everybody wants it all.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's all right just to have enough. Yeah. I've got enough.
Yeah. And I think, but then ironically now, realising that nothing matters, and a switch has gone, and I've been like, well, why can't it be me? Why can't I actually fight and get in the race?
Mm.
Because if it doesn't matter, then it doesn't matter if I lose.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter if I fail.
You've got nothing to lose. Yeah, exactly.
And I think I used to see the race happening of like the industry and like the jobs people are getting and the things people are writing and the things you're not getting and everyone just fighting for their place. And I used to see the race happening and be like, okay, I'm going to just go into my corner, my safe space, and I'm going to pretend that race isn't happening because it will hurt me too much to be rejected from them. And now I'm like, actually, I'm going to go in and I'm going to run. I'm going to try and compete.
Yeah. Because why shouldn't you be allowed?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but then you have a really sobering experience with an audition where you're treated like a piece of dirt. Mm. And then you're, like, crushed. And you, for a minute, forget that you're really fired up and you're actually really excited about everything. And you just have that moment of, oh, I'm not going to get that. I'm useless. And that's how destructive this job is. So you just got to have somebody constantly with you, I think. Yeah. That's why it's quite good, the one with my sister just now, because it's like you just have to, constantly have kind of good things being told to you about yourself from somebody. And it has to be another version of you saying it, because no one else is going to ever do that job for you.
No, you have to say those things to yourself.
You have to, and I never did. But now I'm like, right, actually, you know, what do I still have? What have I got to work with here? That doesn't matter, I'm not going to get that. It doesn't matter.
But that's really healthy to do that. Because you're your own support network sometimes at the end of the day if there's nobody else there.
Yeah. It would be nice to have more support network from... I don't know, but then it's so... Auditions in general, like I find people are really nice to you. So when people are just rude or...
But I think when people are rude in that situation, we have to... stand up for ourselves.
Yeah.
But
then you're worried that people are going to get back to somebody.
Well, fair fucks if it's going to get back to somebody. Mm. I'm sorry, but if you're being treated, if anybody is treated or disrespected like that in a room, they should stand up for themselves. And whether that manifests itself in saying it there and then, or you leave and you pick up the phone and you go, do you know what? I've just had a really terrible time and I'm going to tell you why, and I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
Because if they're saying something like that to me, what are they going to say to somebody who's like 21 and they don't know anything? They're going to think that that's the norm, that that's acceptable, and it isn't acceptable.
Oh, I thought it was for so long. And I'm really glad that I feel like it is a little bit different in the industry now. I feel like people are much more accepting of difference and like people being... I don't know. I feel like about 10 years ago, it was much more straightforward. Everybody was much more taking themselves really seriously. I think hopefully it is a little bit different now. But for a long time, I had really bad experiences time and time again at auditions or in jobs, and I wouldn't say anything because I thought that would affect me getting another job.
So many people do think that.
Yeah.
Still.
And
no.
I thought, I'll be blacklisted. I'll be blacklisted. I won't ever get seen by that person again, or I won't ever get seen by that director again. But I do think I was. I genuinely, which is why it's really scary, because I'm like, I genuinely think that because I said something, I didn't work for a long time in theatre.
And is that where you wanted to work, though?
Well, I would have if I got it. Yeah. I would have, I, you know. And so I do actually think it does. I still think it does. There is some dark forces at play.
Well, there is. You know, I mean, there's a team that people would say, oh, it's all right, don't worry, people have got short memories. And then there's the other side where you go, people never forget.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So it's like, well, what am I going to do?
I don't know, but you have to then, I don't know, it's maybe quite liberating to be like, well, fuck it then. Like, it doesn't
matter.
I suppose
you've got to make a choice at the end of the day. Whether, you know, I'd hate to think that anybody feels that they're constantly treated like a doormat, because they don't deserve to be.
You know,
I talk about this time and time again, you know, everybody's, whatever job you're doing, everybody's got a specific role in that job. Nobody's higher or lower than anybody else. So everybody should be treated the same.
Mm.
And it's only certain higher powers that would elevate somebody to a different position.
Mm.
And that isn't really on.
No. I agree. It is definitely... Everyone has a role, and everyone has a reason to be there and everybody is just doing their job. But so many times I've been on things and I've been like, the hierarchy is just disgusting. You feel like there is, you don't speak to that person, you don't look at that person, don't even look at that person in the eye. Kind of thing. And I think it is one of those really strange things where it's just accepted. I would like to kind of, hopefully if I do ever get another job, it would be nice to try and one day say something about all of it, because if I've had bad experiences on certain things, then I mean, a lot of young actresses and men have had this kind of thing.
Well, exactly. That's what I always think about, you know, just saying about that audition. Then if someone's speaking like that to me, God, if they're going to be speaking like that to everybody else, and then you go, oh, maybe it's just me.
Maybe they just don't like you.
Maybe just like me.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is probably right, to be honest.
Yeah. No. But yeah, it's so different in America with auditioning. I find like it's so much more blunt. They're just like, if they don't even look at you almost, it's like so much more like it's just a meat market.
Yeah.
Whereas here it's almost more scary because it seems nice. They seem like they like you.
On the surface.
Yeah. So I don't know which one I prefer really. I do feel more empty in America, but here I almost get so hurt when...
Because you're
so nice to you.
But you're investing in that meeting as well.
Yeah.
So they're going, they'll be nice to me. Therefore, of course I'm going to be nice to you because that's reciprocated and that's what we do as humans. But then you take that out and you go, oh, they really liked me. And then...
It's like going on so many first dates and thinking that you fell in love and then realising that person, just you're one of a few dates he's had that week. He really wasn't that bothered. He kind of forgot about it until like 15 minutes before.
So because of that, do you feel that you can't trust when you go into rooms sometimes?
Yeah. The amount of... And I lost the trust a long time ago.
Do you know when that happened, when you lost the trust?
Yeah, after a series of really near misses of like almost getting something that could have changed my entire life, my entire career. And then... just not getting them. And the belief, you know, when you just really think, oh, I did really well just then. Like, they really liked me. Everyone seemed to really like me. Like, I'm perfect for that. And then not getting them. And then realising, no, I wasn't perfect for it. Or seeing who got it and then watching it and realising that they weren't even that different to you or they weren't actually better than you. Yeah. It was just literally a decision. just they went that way.
Which is completely out of your hands.
Which is nothing. Yeah, exactly. And
you can only do what you do.
Yeah. And realizing, okay, so it's just potluck, really. And I've done everything I can to get myself into that position. I've done well to get there. I did my best job in the room, and that still wasn't enough. Well, enough isn't the right word, but it still didn't work.
Enough for them. Enough for what they wanted. Yeah.
And then just realizing. It's just futile even really hoping that you're going to get it. So now I don't have any hope. And I don't audition enough to get bruised. I mean, the more I audition, the more neurotic I get. So I'm lucky because I audition for I go in like bouts of doing little bits and then not for a while. And then because I have these other jobs, like I don't get so caught up about it. But when I don't even now believe I'm going to get it.
Would you ever think about just... cutting that part out of your life altogether?
Yeah, I have so many times. But then I think it's like slamming a door and be like, I'm slamming the door now, I'm leaving, so you all should care. And no one being on the other side of the door, no one cares. No one's even, there's just an invisible, there's no one in the room. No one would notice if I did that. So I don't think there's any point in me being like, right, I'm not going to audition anymore.
Do you not think that would be freer, though, for you? Do you not think there'd be a sense of release?
Well, it was in America, because I went to America just to talk about the projects I have that are in development here. And I was only seen as a writer. They didn't even know, really, that I acted.
Right.
And that was so funny, because it did come up sometimes. I'd be like, yeah, I was in Harry Potter, or yeah, I did this, or I did that. And they would be like, oh, yeah. Oh, and I'd be like, you don't realise how that, like, that's like getting cut. You just cut me on my arm.
Yeah.
You've just hurt me really badly. I think that would be a few years down the line. because I do get enough false hope every so often, like enough of an ego boost from auditioning, to believe that one day I might just, like a 10p machine, one day I just might just... And then something happened recently which made me not quit.
What was that?
So I got a job years ago with my... I played, like, the young... I won't say who it is, actually. But anyway...
We can beep anything out, so don't worry.
It actually is not relevant, but the casting director of it...
Yeah.
Really liked me and took a chance on me. And... it was quite a big film for me, even though my main scene got cut. It was still nice. At the premiere and stuff, I had a really nice chat with her. Like, I really like this casting director, and I really believe that, because everyone would be like, oh, once you're in with that casting director, you're like, that's really good for you. And I thought, oh, my God, because she casts films I love. I was like, oh, my God, this is... That was years ago, and then nothing ever again, and no auditions even from her. And I just thought, oh, that's weird, because, I really thought she liked me. I thought that... I thought she'd at least get me in the room again.
Which is odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think that and then just nothing.
Nothing. And then this year, just after Ben died, just got an offer in. It was only a pilot, but it's still I really liked the pilot. Yeah. And I was like really excited about it. And
also how lovely just to be trusted and offered
something. Yeah, she just gave it to me. Yeah. And it's the same casting director. And it was like, oh, so no, she does like me. She does. And this is like 6 years later.
Why are you playing with my heart like this after all these years?
And realising if you just make a connection with someone once, even if it's 6 years later, it might change your life again. And I don't think it will get made or whatever, but at least she's validated that.
But that's not the point, and you can't even think like that. She's validated that, and it goes back to what I was saying a while ago, that, you know, people never forget.
No. And actually for her, it might not be that long. Because maybe she does such big films, maybe she does like two a year. Mm. Like actually, this isn't such a long time.
No.
But it feels so desperate when you're in those first few months or first few years of like time just moves differently for everybody. So that was quite like reassuring, realizing, you know, the good experiences I have in the room quite frequently with auditioning, like actually that it is doing a job. Auditioning is a job.
Well, it's part and parcel of it, yeah.
Getting the part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting the part is actually just a part of that job.
Mm.
So that's changed my outlook quite a lot.
But you know, you were talking about an ego boost before, which fucking hell, we all need, you know.
Yeah.
Not in a masochistic way, but we just sort of need that. Do you not get that from sort of your shows?
Now I do. And... I think this entire experience with this show, because it's just done better than I could have imagined, and it's all come about from just writing honestly and sitting down and writing it just for me.
Yeah, it doesn't really get more honest.
Exactly. But, like, the whole process was honest. Like, I even when I did them... Because I didn't even think I was going to go to Edinburgh with it. We were broken up and I was really low and I just found out that he had... So basically the show is all about me finding out that my ex-boyfriend, in a year where I thought that we were going to be getting back together, had actually fucked London. and I'd found out about the first batch of people he had had sex with. And I was kind of, I mean, neurotic doesn't define how I was really, really distressed. And I went away for a little bit on my own. My mum was like, you just have to just go away and just try and, right.
Yeah.
And my little girl was really tiny, but I did, and I went away and I just wrote it for myself. And then I wrote it
without the intention of it being a show.
Yeah, ever.
So it was a real form of therapy just to get it out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was almost like writing down evidence of how I felt at that moment of what he had, you know, been doing.
Yeah.
It was like a way of me understanding what had happened. And
understanding how you're feeling at that moment as well. So you can see the words in front of you.
And see that it was over.
Yeah.
The relationship was over. Because I didn't believe it until he had said that. And I didn't realise he was protecting me by not telling me. And actually, honesty isn't always the best thing. And what I had done is, like, grab him and get it out of him, the honesty.
Yeah.
And actually, that hurt me so much. It did lead me to writing the show, which I'm really glad I've written. But it's the whole process has taught me so much about relationships and how you sometimes don't need to know everything about the person you're even with. It is actually better sometimes not to.
What else has it taught you?
It's taught me that I'm okay on my own, which I just didn't think I would be.
No, because you were just saying a while back, you know, well, I never had a boyfriend and all this, and yeah. Now you feel comfortable.
Yeah, I feel like I understand a mature relationship, and I also realise that having sex with loads of people doesn't mean that he doesn't still love me. It's just something completely different.
Yeah.
And I think realising that there are so many different types of relationship, and our version of a relationship is really weird, but it works, and it people wouldn't, people just, I think people coming to see the show think it's going to be me getting upset about the fact that I've been rejected and getting, and he's bad because he went and he had loads of sex with loads of random women when I was at home looking after the two young children. It's not that simple.
No.
It's so much more complex.
And it's not that type of show.
It's actually me being the bad guy. It's me being the neurotic, kind of like slightly manipulative, one in control in a way, and I go on my own journey with like dating or whatever, and realize in that relationship that I don't want to be with someone. I'm actually okay doing it on my own. I don't need someone to come and save me with my children because I've got their father there, and I've got my mum, my sister. I've got enough. So it's just it's a story of an unconventional relationship and an unconventional breakup. And, you know, ironically, now we are back together, and it's weird because it's like, it's shown me that we've kind of cleansed ourselves of everything because we've destroyed each other. Like, I've destroyed everything, and we've both hurt each other a lot. And it's quite, yeah, I just feel
like... And now you've put yourself back together, and it's completely different to what it was.
And we look normal. We look like we're just this normal, like, conventional family. Like, we were... whenever we're out together, which I do say on the show, but like whenever we're out together, I'm just always so, I find it so funny because we must look like we're just, oh, they must have just, you know, got together and then decided to have kids. Like they're probably married. Like they have no idea how weird our entire relationship is and how it's just chance. Like, which is essentially what we did. We took a chance. We had a one night stand. I got pregnant and we just took a chance. But yeah, so it's just been an amazing experience doing the show in general because it is my story, but by doing it so many times and by my own circumstances whilst doing the show, which is at first it was like raw, so difficult to do out loud. I was reading it out loud from the script in front of an audience and I was kind of editing as I went. Whenever they laughed, I'd like write down when they laughed. Whenever they didn't laugh, I'd write that down. When words that lines that I thought, why are they laughing at that? And then realizing actually, oh, it's because it's got a completely different meaning actually.
To them. Yeah, exactly.
So the whole way it was actually put together was so natural. So that when I actually eventually did the show, so I had the guts to go and do it in Edinburgh, and I did it in a tiny, tiny room to 40 people every day in the tiniest room. And it was like another form of just exposing myself to strangers. You know, you couldn't even get out the room by brushing past these strangers. Like they would, after the show, I would almost cry every day. It was incredibly just a complete, amazing experience, but also quite draining. And then when I did the show in a massive theatre, like for me, like the main theatre, Soho Theatre, which has always been like my dream, and it was like weird. It was like, and then to do it so many times, and then to go on tour to so many different various theatres, like big ones, tiny ones. It's now not really me anymore. It's me acting. So something I did to get away from acting
has brought you back.
Has brought me back. So and then on top of that, with Ben. And doing the show to kind of save me and my family, it's another form of acting.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's so weird, the whole experience.
This show's done so many things for you.
Yeah.
You really look at it all.
Yeah. And it's taught, and now I've written a pilot and it's with a channel, and like, it's like, that's the quickest process, that's the quickest it's ever been for me. So I've been in development a lot of times. But this is how small-minded a lot of TV development is.
Yes.
Unless they have a thing, which they've seen, has done okay, they've got like the play text, they can see it.
Yeah. And also somebody else has been to see it.
Somebody else has been to see it. They've sent other people.
And they've gone, you've got to go and see that.
Yeah.
So you just leapfrog.
Yeah.
Right over to the other side.
They were like, just write the script.
Yeah.
And I did it. And it was the easiest process it's ever been. So after something which has taken a long time to develop and write, and it's changed so much from the first preview to the 120th show, and I'm still doing it, and it will change in Edinburgh probably. It's the actual script writing was the easiest part of it. And it was almost like adapting someone else's work. It was weird because it doesn't feel like me anymore.
Right. Is it an adaptation of...
Yeah, so like the pilot episode is like the first scene in the play.
Right, okay.
So it's just been the easiest thing for me to do.
Yeah.
And it probably will get rejected by the channel, but...
Stop saying...
But it probably will.
I know, but at least... Do you know what? Maybe it won't.
Maybe it won't.
Let's say it now.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Do you know what? It might do well, Liz.
Well, whatever the case, I have a script I'm really proud of, and it will be used for other things. Like, if it will be used to be sent to other people. So even if this doesn't work... So now I'm saying, like, with the casting director who eventually got back to me, like, this is a thing that a lot of hard work has gone into writing this... The 30-minute script isn't... It doesn't even begin to summarise the amount of work that's... It's so embedded with other things, the whole thing. It actually could be something for me in the future that might be something different. It's been a brilliant journey and something that I don't think I'll ever do again. Like now, it's...
What, in the content way, that sort of confessional...
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever do that again. Because it's just... What it means is that you... people think then that's all you can write about.
Oh, and that's your style. That's what he or she does... They just scoop their heart out and they throw it.
So it probably is all I can do, but I need to try doing something else.
No, it isn't. I don't believe that. I think you can do many, many things.
But yeah, I do feel incredibly vulnerable afterwards because they just got everything of me and I don't know anything about them. So it's a little bit kind of discombobulating.
Mm.
But I really recommend doing it. And I really recommend that way of writing something. Of like sitting down in front of an audience. I mean, you have to have an audience, but usually they're people that like you anyway, and you hear them respond, and that informs your writing.
Yeah.
And then you go back with the edited version, and then that gets edited. So it's been like, by the time I got to Edinburgh after doing it, say 15 times, it was like 15 drafts. So it's a really good way of doing it.
And that's a really important process to start. The edit
I didn't realize how that is what writing is editing. The sooner you do it and write the first thing, just get it out because you're gonna have to edit it a million times. So I think people agonize about actually putting one line down, like getting the first page right or getting the second. Actually just get it out and that process then can begin.
Do you know when you went away to write, even without the intention of writing the show, when was the moment where you went, oh, this is going to be a show? Was there a specific moment when that happened, or did it just organically sort of grow?
I think it was writing down one story. So I think the show is like six stories. And one of them I wrote because it was such a... it's about me going to a Harry Potter convention in Paris.
Yeah.
And I remember I was like, because it was a really weird weekend. I mean, they're weird conventions anyway, but like, I was like, I need to send this to Alfie. Because like, we weren't back together or anything.
Right.
But I knew that he would be up, well, I wanted him to be upset. And I also thought, he always surprises me with how upset he gets about things that I didn't think he would get upset about. Like, because he's so secure and fine. But then I was like, let's see how he responds to this. So I sent it because he's really great with me and my stuff. Like he's always very good at I trust his opinion.
Right.
So I sent it to him and I was like, okay, so this is a story I've written. I just thought I'd send it to you because basically I talk about him also with a... I talk about going to have sex with him as well to try and, like, prove that I can have meaningless sex with my ex-boyfriend who I'm still in love with. And so I said, so I really want to write about these two things, and I just thought that you might have an opinion on it because you... Just basically, am I allowed? I mean, I would have done it anyway, but I wanted him to say you're allowed. And sure enough, he was like, okay, I'm not entirely happy with you talking about us having sex, partly because he was still shagging everyone and I don't think he wanted it to be known that I was also in the picture because that might jeopardise his chances because people would think, right, stay away from that because Jesse is a psycho. So I sent it to him and then he was like, it is really funny. That is quite funny. And I hadn't really thought of it as funny yet. But it gave me the confidence to be like, actually, no, that is, it is ridiculous. Some of the things I've done, and it's also ridiculous, the situation, and the setting alone. Yeah. So I think that's what gave me the confidence to be like, okay, it could be a comedy, but I didn't write it as a comedy. I wrote it verbatim. Of what
I think it's so many things. I really do. I felt loads of things when I came to see it, which, you know, ended up with a small tear. Uh-huh. But yeah, I think also, that's all right. That's good.
Yeah. Well, that's also what's so strange because it has been called a comedy, where actually it's a lot of fucking heavy stuff. And also, I think because it is, I do talk about rape, and I had always been like, just thought, oh, that would affect my career if I talk about the fact that I was raped by my tennis coach when I was 15. Like, that's going to affect my career. So stupid of me. Like, I mean, first of all, no one in any review that I've had of this, no one has even mentioned it because it's not what the show's about. Yeah. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be like, it's an awful contradiction, but you don't hear many successful rape stories. Like, it's not that it wasn't a good rape. It was a bad rape, but it was, I'm not destroyed. And I think so often people hear the word rape and they think, right, ruined.
Yeah.
And I don't want that to keep going on. I want it to be like, okay, you can have something awful happen to you and you can still be okay. You can still have normal relationships. You can still have normal sex. Like, you can still have, you can still not be afraid of things. Like, and I think hopefully that comes across too. I mean, some people sometimes even miss the fact that I talk about that, but like...
Really?
Well, I think sometimes, oh yeah, you do talk about rape, don't you?
I forgot about that.
But that's also something that I did have to really consider doing. And I'm so relieved by the outcome of that.
Yeah, I bet. How was Alfie when you went, here's the show I'm going to be doing?
I think he's really relieved it's over and it's almost over because it's been a long time. And it's really awkward sometimes with how much we talk to each other about our jobs because he's a stand-up comedian. That's his job. That's his identity. I have just been quite lucky because I've done shows and it's been classed as comedy.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think he's sometimes like, it's his territory, but, and I keep getting in on it, but,
there's so many different forms of...
Yeah, he gets quite annoyed comedy. When it's called stand-up. And it's not stand-up.
Well, it's... No, it's...
But he does get quite, like... It's
he gets territorial about it.
He gets a bit prickly about stand-up, which I find quite... It's true. It's not fucking stand-up comedy. Stand-up comedy... I couldn't go onto a stage and do what he does, which is rouse, you know, an audience. And I've seen him do... I've only actually just appreciated the difference lately because I've gone to see him do clubs... Which I've never really, I would never do clubs. I'm not I have puppets. Like I wouldn't be able to do a club.
Yeah.
But I've gone to watch him and I've been like, oh wow, it's sometimes it's quite traditional. You go on and you do whatever you can to make that audience on a Friday night laugh. And it doesn't have to be like very clever or ever. You make them laugh. That is your job. And then you go home.
Well, it's a completely different skill set to something like what you were doing, specifically with that show. Mm.
But that's what really annoys me about him because he would actually be, he has this, he wants to be a comedian and that's all, but I think actually I could just quit everything, just be his manager. That's what I want, but he won't let me. But yeah, so I think he's quite excited about me not just writing about him.
And are you going to go back to Edinburgh?
So I'm finishing it in Edinburgh. I'm doing like 10 days, like to finish it off because when I did it, it was to 40 people last year. And now this is a massive venue for me. It's like 200, almost 300 people.
Oh, so this is the last time you're going to do
Sunrise? Yes, just 10 shows.
And then you're out.
And then I'm out. And then I'm doing 10 shows with my sister. So we're starting the process of doing a new show, and I'm doing it with her.
Which would that be for next year?
For next year.
Right.
And we're going to do the same thing I did with Sunrise, with just do it in front of an audience and edit as we go.
Well, if that process seemed to work last time,
yeah,
why?
I really enjoyed it. And even if it doesn't work, I think what we're trying to do is take control back with our lives. So I think with our brother dying and everything, I think it's like with the rape thing, people think you're ruined. And I think we want to go on stage and like be in front of people, and to, we're not going to talk about it, but we're going to definitely, you know, not be afraid of showing people that we're going to keep going and we're not ruined.
Yeah.
Which I think is, I just never even, because I just, you don't think about this kind of thing happening. And I never thought about how I would handle it. But I think the second it happened, I was like, well, that's it then. That's it. We're done. And I think after, you know, it's so recent, but I think I have to show people that we're going to be okay, and that you can still find humour in things. And that definitely is what's happened lately. I've realised that we've laughed harder than ever. And I now understand what comedy does for people. So I think that we have things to say, but like, I don't know, we're still really early in the process. It's mainly about us trying to write together.
Have you done that before?
We've tried to write together. Like because she's so much younger, I've always written like sketches and stuff, and she's been in them. Like my first Edinburgh show, the idea was a book club, and I was the leader of the book club, and she was my assistant, but she was 14, and we had this like little cardboard house, and she would crawl out of it, and I would be horrible to her. It was very, very basic, but it was really fun to do together. And I think what this experience has taught me with Ben and everything is like, I just want to have a nice time with her. I want to make good experiences and do something in front of people and have a fun time with my sister. And write something hopefully that makes people feel less scared about something happening to them, which could ruin them. Like we're going to make the most of living.
Do you think you worry less now?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think I worry more about, I think because of the nature of how he died, which was a complete accident, I've lost trust in the world. Because I've been like, well, that could be the last time you see someone. You could say goodbye and that's it.
Yeah.
Now that that has happened to me. So I'm much more, I say goodbye a bit heavier. And I don't take anything for granted. And I think actually that's a gift.
Yeah,
it and there
really
are
is.
So many gifts he's given already. Like with, I now appreciate how amazing it is to actually live. Like, I think everyone, until something has happened, until they've experienced some form of loss, like, you don't realise how you take life, just tiny little things for granted. And I think, and I won't ever do that again. I mean, also, I think I'm really lucky because of the age of my kids. They're like 4 and 3. Like, it's a great age.
It's a great age, yeah.
Because everything is, like, amazing. And everything is... They're so present.
Yeah.
And I think that I lost for a long time. I don't think I've ever been so present.
But I think we all lose that from time to time. And again, it's kind of a bit of a roller coaster. But when we are present and we see everything just slightly differently, and we do appreciate those things.
Yeah.
It's really important.
And appreciating moments. So like I try and write down every day, like just tiny things they've said or things that just pull me out of the sadness. And I mean, the other day I was feeling, I've never suffered with depression or anything. I'm a highly anxious person, but I've never known what it means to be depressed. And I've had close people to me be depressed and not quite got it.
Yeah.
Now I get it.
Yeah.
And I realise the weight of that. And so I'm starting to feel like days where I'm like, oh, I think that's depression actually, which I... I can't believe it's taken me this long to feel that. I'm very lucky. But the other day, I was lying down on the bed in the day, which is quite unusual for me.
Probably because you don't get any time to do
don't
that.
Don't have any time. But, like, my daughter, she came, she noticed that I wasn't in the room, so obviously came to find me and was like, well, I'm not going to have her lie down, and just came up to me, and she's got tiny little arms, but she was like, pick your head up, and she put her arm under my head so she could just feel like she was, like, close to me. And she's basically looking after me.
Yeah.
And I just was like, it just brought me out of this moment of just such sadness to be like, oh, no, hang on a second. I need to be looking after you. Like, this is a, I'll get up now. Like, and it just saved me. And so, yeah, I just feel much more like alive in a way, which is just so annoying that this kind of thing had to happen to make you feel like that. But I've lost trust with... I'm now kind of like quite prepped for disaster, which I think is a good thing because I'm more prepared. But
yeah.
I think that will come back. Apparently, you get more, you know, like normal life does resume. But that's also weird because then when normal life is resuming, you're like, but hang on, this thing has happened.
And that part of it, we're carrying on, but that part's missing.
Yeah,
the part that should be there isn't there.
Yeah,
but you're still saying that we have to carry on because life just doesn't stop.
But then realizing that, so it, like being on the tube and like I got a funny text and I was laughing and a train pulled in of strangers, and I realized that anyone who had been looking at me from that train would have seen me just smiling at my phone and think, oh, there's a happy woman, and they wouldn't know that that text was like so fucking dark about something that just happened, but like in a darkly funny way, and it made me laugh. They wouldn't know the situation that I'm in, that, right, the horror of the situation.
Yeah.
And then getting on the train and sitting with these people and then thinking, I'm just a happy woman. And realising, actually, no, everyone has probably got their fucking awful thing that's happened.
Absolutely.
Just
yeah.
in a different way.
Yeah.
Like, and that's quite amazing because I now have an empathy I didn't have before, that you don't know what that person's gone through that day, in that morning.
But that's that thing when whatever happens, or someone snaps at you, or just something bad happens and it's directly to you and it affects you, you've got to go, well, wait a minute, I don't know what's going on with them. So
yeah.
They're having a really shit day and they've just taken it out on me, and tomorrow they might be absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But we don't know what's going on with that
yeah.
person.
Oh, it's great realising that. But I just did it just now after this horrendous audition just now. So it was quite a degrading thing, and then walking along with my sister, and then three schoolboys, they probably were about 14, like bumped into me, really hurt me, and then walked on and didn't say sorry. And I just stopped, I turned around, and I said, excuse me, excuse me, boys. Boys, you just hurt me. And I thought they were going to be like, oh, fuck you, bitch, or whatever, but they were like, oh, I'm really sorry. And they were really nice to me. And I was like, okay, I probably look absolutely insane. Like, I already look insane by how I dress. But now I just look so angry and horrible. And then I just felt so much better because I said, like... So, yeah, I have moments like that more, which I wouldn't usually say. I wouldn't have usually said anything to them.
You'd have kept quiet.
Mm. But I think I was taking out my anger at the audition on these schoolboys.
Exactly, you see? Those boys now be looking at you going, it's all right, lads, we don't know what's going on with her today. She might be having a really bad day. Turns out she was. Jessica
yeah.
Cave, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That was really lovely talking to you.
Thank you. I'm like, I've just been such a fan of
you. Oh, shut
up. It's so funny.
I'm so thrilled you came on. Honestly, I've never been talking about this for ages, haven't we?
Yeah, and thank you for sitting through my show.
Thank you for getting me a ticket. I absolutely, you know I loved it. It's brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
And another episode is done. What an episode. Myself and Jesse and Griff, we left Maison Bateau after that. We'd do some photos outside. It was a beautiful day. And we carried on talking for at least another 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And, yeah. She's a one. She's just brilliant. Now, look,
If you're in Edinburgh throughout, well, I say throughout, between the 14th and the 25th of August, Jesse is performing Sunrise, which you really do need in your life. It's just such a brilliant show. She is at the Assembly, George Square Studios, right? 6:30, August 14th to the 25th. And it's a nice thing, right? If you've got a little bambino, if you've got a baby, babies don't require a ticket. You can take your baby free of charge. So scoop up the baby, go along, see Jessie perform Sunrise, because I don't think she's going to do it again. I know she's doing something next year at Edinburgh Festival with her sister, who is obviously spoken about in this episode, which hopefully, if I've got time, I'll be straight up to Edinburgh. I'm not there this year. I can't be. I was there last year for a bit, and it was extraordinary, extraordinary stuff. So, what do I have to say? I have to say, can you do me a favour? Right, you know this podcast is free. It's supported by you. You don't hear any adverts on here at the moment. Who knows in the future? But at the moment, we've been doing this over 2 years. It's fiercely independent, and it's supported by you, the listener. So go to Patreon and click on Patreon.com/The Two Shot Podcast. If there's anything you can do to help us out, that would be greatly appreciated. But look, that's why the Patreon thing is so brilliant. Because if you can't afford it, somebody's going to do it for you. And then when you can, you'll do it for somebody else. It will continue to be free. That's just the way it is. And we'll continue giving you conversations with guests that hopefully you won't hear anywhere else. I mean, you might hear the guests, but you won't hear these exact conversations. I mean, in the coming weeks, I know for a fact the next 4 weeks of guests have never done a podcast before. And also, we're lining up something very special for our Christmas episode this year. All I'm saying is, it involves a previous guest and the fact that we're going to cook a Christmas dinner and we're going to record it as a podcast. Look, don't know. It's going to be fine. Nothing. What can go wrong? What can go wrong? It's going to be fantastic. Look, if you can't afford to support us in any way with a pint or a cup of coffee a month, that's fine. Don't worry about it. But if you can, fantastic. If you can't, then go and tell people, retweet, post about it on social media, just tag us in, because word of mouth is key for this. We would never be 2 years down the line and have the support that we have if it wasn't for you lot on social media. And it's fine that not all of you give us any money. It's not what we ask for. It's just the support. If the support's there, the episode's there, and that's the way it is. You can tell I'm tired, my voice is going. Look, I'm going to go, but look, have a brilliant week. I'm going to get some sleep, and yeah, look, please take care of yourself, look after yourself, and be kind to other people. Unless people are not kind to you, in that case, fuck them off. No, I'm joking. Don't do that. Just, you know, look, everybody has a bad day. We've all had those bad days. We've all been that person. Okay? Right. I'm going to go with these stupid, ridiculous pearls of wisdom, and they're not. Don't listen to me. I'm just dead tired. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson, and he's been Producer Griff, and this has been The Two Shot Podcast. Thank you so much. You look after yourself, all right? I'll see you next week. Take care. Bye. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.